Rock, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weissett. This week, our big topic is the controversy between, or the battle between, pins and clips. Mm-hmm. How should you have your wrap set up? But before we get to that, we are going to hit the email box. We've got a couple of emails we want to respond to. First, we got a response from an email last week. Zach, you want to hit that?
Yeah, so Bruce emailed us a bunch of funny things, and he emailed me back directly, and we were talking about having perimeter lines or danger ropes across the raft in an R2 situation. And we talked last week about they're really useful for waterfalls, for big drops. And he sent me a video of some guys doing the Clackamas, and I watched it. We'll put it in the show notes. If you go to our website, there's a link to it. There'll be a link to it. But I think on like class 3, things like the upper Clackamas, that line across the thwarts that you'll see in the video is probably less helpful than it is on waterfalls and maybe adds a danger. So, Bruce, that's a good point. I don't think you have to have lines across the thwarts when you're rafting all the time. It's maybe more dangerous, and I would personally not do it unless you are falling out a lot and you need extra things to hold on to. And you'll notice if you watch the whole video, they fall out on the Clackamas, even with these things to hold on to. So I'm not criticizing the boaters. I'm just saying I would choose not to put these lines across the thwarts unless it's a really hard river where I want to stay in over waterfalls. So that's it.
Perfect. Well, good. There we go. So we also got an email from Dan on the East Coast. And I love Dan's email, so I'm just going to read it because I don't think I could do justice to it if I was trying to paraphrase it. Hey, y'all, live near Washington, D.C., mid-Atlantic region, fairly large contingent of boaters belonging to clubs. I've noticed a correlation with these groups. The more members of a crew with fingerless gloves and or face cages, the more likely that group is to have swimmers and general carnage. Do fingerless gloves and face cages make you more likely to swim? Have you noticed a similar correlation out west? I enjoyed the show. I preferred the earlier episodes where your rants were not encumbered by the fear of angry emails from listeners. Truth be damned. Rant away.
We haven't had any angry emails from listeners.
No, we haven't. And honestly, Dan, I think that would only encourage us to rant more. So yeah. We'll keep the rants coming.
I've tried really hard to get people to rant at Priscilla on her stereotypes, and nobody said anything mean about that yet. No. I've done the best I can.
So fingerless gloves, I just had a memory of guiding, and I have a pretty distinct memory of the customers that wore the fingerless gloves falling out more often than people without. I think there might be a correlation there.
Yeah, so we have lots of clients who come on, you know, they're paddling an inflatable kayak for the first time in their lives and doing like, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 day trip or whatever. And in those situations, it's like, okay, I'll actually kind of advise maybe the gloves of some kind, because otherwise we're almost for sure going to be taping your hands for blisters, because you overgrip the paddle and your hands aren't used to that kind of thing. That's, to me, a different conversation. Then like, I bought a boat, I go boating, I am a boater, and I wear fingerless gloves. That is different. So I would tend to agree. If you wear like, you know, a full face cage helmet, or people I see with a full face cage helmet, I feel like there's a higher likelihood they're going swimming. It seems to be a truth that I've seen. And fingerless gloves, both in the context of kayaking and rowing a raft. I feel like you're more likely to see carnage if that's happening. It just, those two things seem to go together. It seems to be a West Coast truth as well, in my opinion. But
do kayakers, Zach, do hard shell kayakers wear fingerless gloves? I've never seen that.
I've never seen that.
Yeah.
I've seen, oh no.
I have on the Rogue. It's like hard shell kayakers on the Rogue, and they're in like dancers and you know, whippets, and
so maybe it's a sign of
boats
of, the time.
Boats of a certain age.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe
something back in the day that was normal.
Paddling in a wetsuit.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a correlation because people who are klutzes tend to wear more safety stuff. You know, they know they're an issue. They know they're probably gonna fall out more, so they wear the full face helmet. And you know, they're, I don't know why you'd wear fingerless gloves, but I guess not to get blisters. So people that get hurt a lot probably pad up. And so maybe that's why there's a correlation. But I don't see it that much personally. It's not like a big
That's a
thing in
good
the West Coast.
hypothesis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I don't
if,
see it as much as I used to, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. But on our
I think it
packing
used to just
list,
be a thing too.
yeah. What was?
I think like, that used to be more of a thing. Like you look back on some of, I feel like when you watch like old kayak videos, like or you see old photos and stuff, and I'm talking like old. Like dancers being like the modern boats of the time. Like fingerless gloves, you see, like you look back on old photos, and like that's not an uncommon thing to see people have.
That's true.
From stuff back then, it seems like. But
We put it on our
I don't
packing list as an optional thing. So when people come on trips, we say optional, bring, we say bike gloves for the same
Yeah.
thing for blisters. But I wonder if
Yeah.
there's, if it's just gloves. It's not just fingerless gloves, it's just gloves.
Yeah, I'm
Yeah.
sure. But there's something about like, there is, whether it comes out of like crew or something, I do think that there's an association in people's minds that if you're boating, you wear fingerless gloves, not fingered gloves. We sell more fingerless gloves out of our store than fingered gloves. We have both, and we'll sell twice as many fingerless ones. Like easy.
Are they boating specific fingerless
They are the
gloves?
NRS. Yeah, they're the NRS boating gloves, but
Oh,
I
cool.
think they're exactly the same as a bicycle glove. They just put NRS on them. I don't think there's a big difference. So there's like a cheap like fingerless road biking glove.
Yeah.
But
Well, I think we'll
yeah. What
try to
about
see if we can
rowing?
observe that.
Do you wear gloves when you row, Zach? Are
No.
you a glove person?
No. And no, I'm not. First of all,
Say it with a little more judgment there,
if
Zach.
no, if I was, I
No.
really enjoy the rad scale, and I mean, I have to say, people that wear full face helmets and fingerless gloves are very low on the rad scale. But I shouldn't say that because I'll probably smash my face on a rock tomorrow kayaking. So that's just
Well,
like bad
and
karma for
I don't
me.
think he's talking about full face helmets. Like, I don't think he's talking about like the full
They're
face, like the,
like the
like,
hockey masks almost.
yeah, like the old school hockey mask. Like, I think
Has
that's what
like
he's
the
talking
thing
about.
down the middle. Yeah, like the metal bar down the middle and then the two across the chin.
Yeah, or like an old football helmet looking thing. Like, I think that's what he's getting at. But I think it's like, yeah, more like the hockey mask thing. You know, like a full face suite helmet or something. That's a different story in my mind.
I row enough to where I have calluses, so I don't need to protect my
Yeah.
hands. But on the when we paddle the we row the wind a lot in the winter, and there's a group of guys, the Wind Riverman Gentlemen's Boating Club, and we go out and it's the saying is for those who like civility with their class 5 boating, and we go all winter long. You know, the wind is cold in December, and you know when you're rowing in December, you want gloves, and so I'll wear gloves then just to keep my hands from freezing. But I don't like it. It has a weird texture. It doesn't feel the same as bare hands, so I prefer not to wear gloves.
If you're wearing them for cold, that to me makes a lot, like that I
That's
have to. I
different.
have my hands get cold real easy, and so I have to. Like that's different than wearing them for blisters or protection or whatever, or sun protection. I feel like that's a thing now. People
Oh,
wearing gloves.
sun paws.
We have ones for sale that like there's no hand part of the glove. It only goes over the back of your hand,
Yeah, no, those are
so it's
called
like
sun
literally
paws.
only.
Yeah,
Oh yeah.
ridiculous. I have two friends of mine I went to college with that are like good friends, longtime guides. They wear sun paws to protect their hands from the sun. And I don't want to make fun of them because I'll probably get skin cancer on the back of my hand because I do. But I do make
I'd
fun
for
of
sure make
them.
fun of that person.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
for
a
sure.
couple of them. It's more than one person.
They're out there.
I don't know. I mean, I think people wear. You know, they wear those hats that cover their whole necks, and they wear long sleeve shirts, and they're like completely covered from the sun, which is probably really smart, I guess.
They're gonna live a lot longer than us, for
I've
sure.
gotten
But
into when I'm rowing a boat, like I've got a big, one of those big like oh, I don't know what the stuff they're made of, but like it's palm hats or whatever. that you see a lot of guides on the Norfolk and stuff wearing them now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've got one of
Those
those
are
big,
nice.
round sun hats, and then I wear like those long sleeve, SPF shirts. NRS makes one, although I don't like theirs as much as, there's some Patagonia ones or whatever that. And I actually found like I really like wearing those because they're cooler. Like, if nothing else, you get them wet and they keep you cool. But then you also have to put on sunscreen, which I hate putting on sunscreen. Not because I'm, I mean, sure, I sort of have the, don't put the chemicals on the skin sort of thing, but more, it's just like a thing to do that takes time and effort. It's like I can put on a shirt or I can have to ask somebody to rub my back.
God. All right. It's time to move on from the email section.
On that note, well, I think it's safe to say we'll try to observe this this trend and see if there's a correlation over on the West Coast more.
Next time
But I
I
think
see
to Zach's point, we
somebody,
don't really see it. Like, it
I
sounds
don't
like this
see
is a
it.
big thing over there, and I don't feel like we even see that much. I feel like I used to see, 15 years ago, you saw a lot more of it, whereas now, it's a pretty uncommon thing to see people kayaking with
I'm picturing a nerd. I'm
clubs
just
and
straight
hockey
up
helmets.
picturing. I'd love to have if you could send us a photo of this in action. I'd love to see what these people look like, the whole outfit. But I'm picturing an inflatable kayak nerd, like engineer type. That's what I'm picturing. Pocket protector along with it, the whole thing.
Well,
Yeah,
I think we have some other news of the week to talk a little bit about. So there's a recent article that the Statesman Journal came out with that is talking about new court decisions. The title of it is "Will New Court Decisions Bring Nanny State into Oregon's Outdoors?" And the context behind this article is there's been a couple incidents where people have injured themselves on public lands and then sued the Parks and Recreation Department for damages. And the reason that this is a little concerning without going into the details of each of the cases is there is a policy called recreational immunity that has been really helpful to opening up access to public and private lands for recreation because it removes the liability of the landowner from people injuring themselves when they are participating in a recreational activity. So as you can imagine, if you're someone that has a chunk of land you want to open as a public park, you don't want to worry about being sued. So if you remove that, the likelihood that someone will open their lands to public use is higher. Somewhere along the road within this legislation, there was a challenge that a runner got injured in a park because a hole wasn't covered after a sprinkler was being repaired. And they sued the staff member that didn't cover the hole. And so it kind of questioned how sturdy this law was. But then in July 2016, in Oregon at least, our legislature corrected this and basically said that landowners and managers are protected by recreational immunity. So, if as long as it's not gross negligence, then if you get injured on public lands, it's kind of your responsibility, and you should basically just be a smart person when you're recreating. And personally, I really like this law because it makes it easier for people to open up access to lots of places. And it makes people more willing, especially when it comes to private property owners, say in the timber industry, one of their primary concerns for closing off areas is garbage, fire, and lawsuits of someone, say, taking their ATV off the road and suing them, or someone swimming and drowning, like all these things. So if you're removing these barriers, the likelihood that they are going to be more open to discussions for people accessing their private lands, the better it is for everyone. So Currently in Oregon, the Statesman's Journal article mentions that there's a couple cases that are back in court, and depending on the outcome of these cases, it may prove that recreational immunity is not as robust as we thought, which could have some very negative impacts to us having access to recreate on public and private lands, because people will then be again fearful of litigation against them for injury. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story is if you haven't read the Zach Urness article in the Statesman and you live in Oregon, Statesman Journal, I would highly recommend it. I think he's personally, I think he's the best outdoor writer in the state of Oregon. I think he's great, and it's really well researched and worth a read if you have any interest in this stuff. But yeah, I mean the general gist of it is right now all these places are open and accessible and you can go use them, and there's not, hundreds of signs trying to lay out every single possible danger that could exist. And, if this takes a turn, there could be closures of places. In the article, one of the things he talks about is the one of the other thoughts that could come out is all of a sudden you could see, huge signs or like an abundance of signs trying to list every possible bad thing that could happen to you in a place. One of the there was kind of three interesting cases that he brought up in the article that really are they are kind of fascinating as you think about them. And one of them is a tragic, I mean, just a tragic situation of a kid at Lake Billy the Chinook, going to some dock where he's been before, and a place he swam a bunch of times, dives off the end into murky water and hits a rock and does all sorts of damage to himself, and now he's in a wheelchair and everything else. I mean, just like the ultimate tragic sort of situation that it's like a nightmare, right? But part of the argument in the case is they've sued is that the rock wasn't there before, that the Parks Department in some project they were doing something trying to shore up, I think erosion is what it said in the article, had moved rocks around, but they hadn't put up any signs saying new rocks. And so is there a sense of liability there? And I think it's an interesting question. Seems like, I don't know. I think that one's fascinating. I think the other one that he talked about in that article was somebody running on a sidewalk, like they were jogging, and the sidewalk had gotten separated or something, or they tripped on a lip and broke their elbow and did a bunch of stuff in Multnomah County and sued the city, I think, for not maintaining the sidewalks. And it ended up getting thrown out because of the recreational immunity, because, or the county tried to throw it out because of the recreational immunity, but then the court said, just because they're jogging doesn't necessarily qualify it as recreation, because if they'd been walking, they could have been walking to work and tripped in the same way on the same hazard, where the only difference was that they were, wearing athletic gear and out there for a workout, not walking, which opens up the conversation around what recreation is and things like that. I think there's a lot of fascinating things happening around this. And personally, I'm with you, Priscilla. I think that the law is really benefits us from a public access standpoint and everything else in the state. And it's a little concerning.
It is. And it's like some of the issues, particularly with whitewater boating in the state, are agencies and groups of people making arbitrary assessments of risk associated with activities. And if a law like this, or if these cases prove that recreational immunity is not that robust, I think it's not unreasonable to assume that decisions made by agencies to limit certain types of recreation on public lands will be done more frequently, because they will not want to take on the potential risk
Sorry, my phones are ringing off the hook right now.
There's worse problems.
they won't want to take on the potential risk associated with an activity that they perceive as high risk, like kayaking, climbing, any of those, what people often call extreme sports that really aren't that extreme. So
It's
I
not
think.
far-fetched to think you could see counties or like county parks closing down boat ramps above certain river levels.
Exactly.
For whatever arbitrary reason is deemed too hazardous.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's really unfortunate that, I mean, some of these accidents that are in court are truly horrifically tragic. In the boat dock instance, that's an interesting case where they probably should have, if it's a man caused altercation, that probably should have been something that was better informed. But in a lot of these cases, it's just naturally occurring circumstances that if you go outside, you're subject to certain risks when you're doing any activity. And I don't like the idea that, especially in the United States, that we default to tort litigation to resolve mistakes that we made as humans.
Yeah, this sucks. I know. Like on the Hood River, there's a bunch of river access that's on private land, or it's not exactly perfect access. And it's every year there's a new change where we can't put in a certain spot. There's signs that go up to say you can't put in here because mm-hmm. of this. And, you know, in one case, you know, there was a store that let us put it in on their property. They were super nice for years. And the highway patrol came by and let them know that they could be sued if somebody gets hurt on the river. So they closed off that access to us.
Yeah.
And there's a private property owner that has property that we use forever. And now we have to do some really sketchy put in that involves the cliffs and rocks are always rolling down. So we had a safe access to the river, but because the private property owner denied us access, probably due to, because he could get sued, we're now doing something more dangerous to get into the yeah. river.
Right.
This bums me out, but.
Me too. Well, we'll see. These cases are in court. The decision has not been made. So it'll certainly be something to watch and see what happens and just, I think if you're someone that is engaged in work with any local counties, agencies, sheriff's departments, I think some of the best things you can do is inform them about the actual risks associated with your sport and be willing to educate them and help them out in what ways you can and have conversations versus start conflict, I suppose. But yeah, this may change a lot of things in the state. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, well, should we move on to our main topic of the week, the battle royale between Pins and Clips and Standard Oarlocks?
Oh, man.
Maybe even throw in some oar rights in there just for fun.
Pro-locks. There we go. Everything.
All the things.
Pro-locks.
All right, so I'm assuming you hippies are into open oars, or I call them spinnies. What do you guys call them again?
Spinnies.
Yeah, because they spin in your hand. Like when you hold them, the oars spin.
Oh.
I call them oarlocks.
Oarlocks. Yeah. I'm assuming oarlocks. I'm assuming you guys are into oarlocks.
Us hippies.
I would say for personal use, I am 100% into oarlocks. With the, I do very little like class 5 cat boating.
Uh huh.
And I could see, we'll get into this, I can see the appeal. If you're in a class 5 cat boat running, you know, something pretty gnarly, that is the circumstance where I can see the benefit of pins and clips.
So you,
outside of that single circumstance.
So you'll concede that, I mean, I think we can finish this topic pretty quick then, that if you're running like class 3, maybe class 4, and you're just enjoying your way down the river, you want oarlocks. That's a good solution. But if you want to go get rad, then you should use pins and clips. Is that are we already there?
No.
No. So I think I have a similar agreement with Eric. So one of the times that I felt like it would have been really awesome to have pins and clips or oarlocks was running Greenwall on the Illinois. Because my oar got kind of jangled and I was like, man, like I don't even actually need to feather or pull my oars in or do anything special. I just need to push and pull. Mm-hmm. And so like I had the epiphany that, oh, this is why people use these things. But in all of my other rowing, I think I would prefer to have oarlocks and just make sure to, you know, hammer them a little bit more close so they don't pop out so easy, before each trip, which I think people kind of forget to do is to check how wide their oarlocks are, and which is one of the reasons they pop out. I also think the pins and clips and oarlocks are a or the pins and clips are a good tool to teach people how to row. I was happy that, I mean, Eric taught me how to feather rowing and do everything in the beginning, which I think was beneficial for me being a more proficient rower. But me turning around and trying to teach other people how to row, the feather is a really kind of daunting thing. And I think when I was teaching at Oregon State University, I found that having the pins and clips was really helpful so that people could just kind of understand how oars worked without making sure that they're pulled close enough together, that their oar blade isn't like in a weird janky position when they're trying to run a rapid. And it progresses the learning for some people that kind of need to break up each part of what it means or like how to row. And then they're able to take on the feathering or any of the other more technical aspects of rowing later on with more confidence.
Yeah, I think pins and clips on that line is good for learning to row because it forces you to ship your oars correctly. I think a lot of people learn early to just pull their oars in and you still have oars sticking out. So when if you never learn how to properly ship your oars, which means pull the handle back so the blade is parallel, the oar is parallel to the boat, that allows you to go through narrow channels. If you have half an oar sticking out after you pulled in, you can't really go through narrow channels. So people
Well, and you
learn.
also set up to guarantee you're breaking the oar.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I've lost so many oar blades that way where they pull the oar in, like they bring it in just to like right where the blade and the shaft meet, and then the blade hits the rock and just like ping, that's the end.
So the
Drive me
proper
nuts.
technique is to learn how to ship, but if you never use pins and clips when you're learning, you're never forced to do that. You're just going to develop this habit to pull the oars in. So I think they're good for, I agree, they're good for teaching. But we, you know what, we also we use orites for teaching, so you don't have to deal with the spinnies. I call them the spinnies because they spin on, they, you know, you have to deal with the spinnies.
I think they're a great teaching tool. I think I kind of have this belief just in general about learning how to boat is like you should, and this relates to learning how to row, is you should be able to row with pretty much any setup if you're a good oarsman. And I think you should also, if you're a good boats person, then you should be able to navigate almost any whitewater craft, whether it's IK, hard shell, cat boat, raft. So I think that belief applies to rowing, in that if someone hands me a boat with pins and clips and orites, I should be able to feel comfortable. I may not like it, but I should feel comfortable navigating whatever. And if someone hands me a boat that just has oar locks and whatever style of oar, I should also be able to be comfortable doing that if I'm an actual good oars person. So I think if you consider yourself a good boater or oars person or whatever, you should be comfortable with whatever setup someone gives you. But ultimately, if you're choosing a setup, it comes down to preference. And like if you're running really hard whitewater where you don't need to do much but pull and push, like pins and clips are probably a great option, but you should also probably be able to do it without the pins and clips.
Yeah, and one generalization, let me know what you guys think of this. People who run open oar locks or spinnies, they cannot handle pins and clips. It's just they can't wrap their brain around it. They can't do it. They hate them because they can't do it. But people that run pins and clips can definitely run open oar locks. You know,
I don't agree with that.
you don't.
I've
I
seen
mean,
the opposite.
I think it depends on what you're doing, right? Like, I can hop on pins and clips and go run something that's really consistent, hard white water, where, like I'm not pushing through any flaps, and that's fine. I'll find it annoying at times, but I can definitely, like, it's doable. But you go out to the flats, like, you give me a heavy boat and put me on pins and clips out in the flats, and I'm just gonna, like, throw the oars in the water and swim
That's
until
the
the boat's timing. It's
worst.
like,
I
it's so
agree.
frustratingly inefficient that, like, it just drives you insane while you're doing
Oh,
it.
it's why is it less efficient?
well, you
Because you
can't
can't get
feather
the oars
through.
into the right position and you're having to lift them out of the water. So you're limiting the muscles in your body that you can use. Like, it actually is physiologically less efficient the way you have to row pins and clips.
Because you have
So
to
like
lift the oars out of the water.
you have to lift the oars out of the water, one. So like all of a sudden right there, and that doesn't sound like a lot, but over 1,000 strokes in the day, it's quite a bit of weight, especially on a big boat.
When I never learned
If you're
how
rowing
to
against an upstream wind, you can't feather the oar against the wind. So now you're pushing against the wind, which we've talked about in non-feathered paddles is a thing, and it's equally, if not more so, in oars. And it's harder because you can't position, you can't pull the oars in and out further or closer. So like if I'm in a heavy boat, I want flats, I'm going to stand up and row a huge chunk of the day because I can use my body weight. I can use literally all the muscles from pretty much my waist up to push the boat and go faster and more efficient. And with pins and clips, that's a lot harder to do because you can't slide the oars in further as you stand up.
And
You
there's
have a lot
also a
less
person.
options, basically.
I don't do any of those things. Like I learned pins and clips. So even when I row spinnies, I never learned how to feather. I always pull my oars out of the
Oh
water no matter
man.
what. I never learned how to feather my oar in the water and just move it. And I don't stand up that much. Just but it's
Oh,
so
it's
like I'm on the
life
Rogue.
changing.
I'll do out of the 40 miles on the Rogue on a given trip, like what, 20 of them are flat? And I'll probably row all 20 of those standing up and not taking my oars out of the water. Because it's
And like
just so much easier.
the feather that you add at the end of your stroke, like keeping the oars in the water and feathering in the water, bringing them forward and backwards, there's actually a significant percentage of the power in your stroke that comes from the feather. And if like once you learn how to do it, you can like push forward, and then that final feather actually brings the boat more momentum than just a standard forward stroke. And that's the same with rowing and crew too. Like the feather is where most of the power comes from, or the final amount of the power and the push comes from in your stroke. So
The
it's
flick gives you extra juice.
yeah,
Like,
exactly. It's like a turbo boost.
so the
I would
very end of
also
the
add, I would
stroke,
also
you
add in
do a
barn
little.
boats.
Let me just want to ask a question because I don't. The very end of your stroke, there's a little twist you do that you kind of push on, and that's what you're talking about. Okay. I felt that before. I've never.
As you're taking the blade from, horizontal to vertical, or from vertical to horizontal, that flick gives you like there's an
No, I
extra
hear
bit
that.
of,
I hear that.
momentum in there.
I felt
And I would
that.
add too, if you're rowing hard boats, drift boats, dories, et cetera, and especially on bigger whitewater, you'll feather the oars a lot because they bounce, they level out the boat. So like especially when you're in like choppy water or whatever, you put your oars in the water and flatten them out, and you significantly widen and lower your center of gravity, so the boat doesn't get jostled around nearly as much. Like your boat can be getting rocked like crazy. You drop your oars in on flat and hold them steady, and the boat will just flatten out, like level out.
I can't
So
imagine
you can
putting
make a
pins and
big
clips on a
difference.
drift boat. That seems insane to me. I don't think that's possible.
I don't think it can certainly be strange. You see people with oar rights every now and then, but I think you're missing that ability to flatten out your boat in waves and feather your oars and things, especially in like a drift boat or a hard boat, is really a important part of rowing those boats, from my experience.
Okay, so let's get
So.
back to something I asked earlier. Do you guys agree with the premise that if you're running generally like class three-ish stuff and flat water, you want open oar locks? When you start running more difficult rivers, then you generally want pins and clips.
I wouldn't quite. I would go a little further than that. So like if I'm running the Illinois, I'm running open oar locks. If I'm running a cat boat on, the wind, like the upper wind, then I would be much more open to pins and clips, because the pins and clips, not only do they, all you have to do is push and pull on your oars, like they're in the right position, they also are something to help hold you on the boat.
Yeah, that's a
You can
huge,
pull on
huge
them and they keep
point.
you in. So you basically have a handle. Whereas if you're rowing in open oar locks, the only thing you have keeping your butt in the boat is your feet, like whatever you're hanging your feet onto. Other than that, like you've got nothing. You're going out the side. So I think for me, the big whitewater part, it's not even as much the locking the oar blades vertically so you know they're ready to go. Like that to me is the minor benefit. The major benefit is the handles holding you in the boat.
Yep, I agree. Absolutely. Like whether you get jostled side to side, it keeps you from going to the side of the boat, or over a steep drop, it keeps you from falling out of the back of the boat because you need to hold on to your handles. And when I watch oar lock people run hard rivers, they let go of the oars all the time and grab their frame, which I think is terrible form. Like you should have your oars in your hand. So when you watch some people, if you watch videos of people that are running oar locks on hard rivers, they push their oars forwards, they throw their oars forward a lot, they let go a lot. Because they have nothing to keep them in the boat. And then it takes a while to recover from that.
It can, yeah.
So let's
There's
go back
certain
to.
places like I'll drop oars, like at Slim Pickens at low water on the Rogue. there's a lot of times I'll pull, especially in a hard boat, to like the last minute.
Uh-huh.
And then by then you're too close to swing your oars forward and ship them.
Mm-hmm.
So I just drop them and they swing, the handles swing forward. The oars go parallel to the boat and you just slide right through.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can be, or I'll drop my right one and hold my left one, but go forward with it instead of backwards.
Yeah.
I think drift boats are a whole other world. Like, I don't understand them at all. It's not, I have no, I can't believe people row those things down rivers on purpose.
If that makes so
it, makes it really hard. Yeah, I it's kind of like teleskiing. It's not that useful, but it's cool and it's a new challenge. It's fun in its own way. So wait,
I'm going to think about that comparison.
I single speed, and I'm a teleskier, so I get it. Like in single speed biking, same thing. You know, you're making it harder on purpose for some extra challenge.
But weren't drift boats and dories like the original crafts?
Yeah, so were teleskis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I don't know anything about skiing, so
there is a sense of tradition that comes with it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, when your friends are jumping
they're
off,
they're also just really sexy.
Yeah. Yeah. When your friends are jumping off a cliff in telly skis or on alpine skis, you're like, I would do that, but I'm on tellies. Like you have a valid excuse. Same thing with a drift boat. Like if you flip in Greenwall in a drift boat, you're like, yeah, but I was in a drift boat.
That's right. Okay.
So it's like it gives you a built-in like layer of like, yeah, but by the way, I'm making it harder on myself.
Yeah, a little bit of the gnar factor.
Yeah, or like I do single speed biking sometimes too. It's the same thing. You can't keep up with your friends, but you are on a single speed, so you have a little bit of an excuse.
It's like a hipster thing.
Oh man, that hurts. That's like a dagger in the heart right there. Ouch.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'm trying so hard to not be a hipster these days. So let's go back because I think we were talking about Greenwall. Priscilla mentioned in Greenwall she noticed she would like maybe like pins and clips. Eric, you said on the Illinois you would not want pins and clips. And I'm wondering, what's the most difficult part about the Illinois? The rapids or the flat water?
I think the rapids. I think I agree with Eric. I would not have pins and clips because it would just be for Greenwall.
Yeah.
I think the rest of the river, it's really nice to not have pins and clips just because it's like a lot of the rapids are pretty technical. So it's nice to be able to move your oars around and be pretty flexible with feathering and that sort of thing is what I'm remembering. And then the flat water was enough that it was nice to stand up, especially at the end. The last stretch is pretty flat. But Greenwall was just, it was certainly the hardest thing I've rowed. And I was certainly out of shape in terms of rowing shape. And I think just, you know, there's a certain degree of grip that you have on your oars when you row all the time. Mm-hmm. And not having that grip strength resulted in my oars getting a little jangled. And I think if I had pins and clips and I had the same issues, I wouldn't have been really worried at all. Yeah. But not having that grip strength was like, oh, my oars are kind of just feathering on their own because of the hydraulics in the river that I'm fighting. And I just had this thought like, oh, pins and clips would resolve this issue. So if I'm just a weekend, well, I mean, realistically, I'm rowing a multi-day river like once a year. So if that's what I continue to do, then maybe I should think about doing pins and clips because I'm not going to have the strength I did as a river guide that was doing it every day. But I think if I do the Illinois again, I'll probably still do just regular oar locks and I'll just try to do something before that trip to prepare for it.
So I understand the difference between where we're getting at about pins and clips and oar locks. Like I agree with you guys at like on the Rogue, I'd rather have oar locks or the Middle Fork of the Salmon. I'd rather have oar locks. But for me on the Illinois, I'd rather have pins and clips just because I would rather not fluff one stroke on Greenwall. I'd rather know I have the best setup for Greenwall. I probably won't make a mistake there, and I'm willing to deal with the pins and clips in the flat water a lot of the other places. But that's just a personal choice. Where it sounds like you guys know if you could switch out, you'd be pins and clips in Greenwall, but you'd rather like make it a little bit more difficult to get the Greenwall to have the oar locks the rest of the time. Does that sound adequate? No.
I'd row open oar locks through Greenwall. I'd prefer to. I don't, again, for me, the main benefit to them is the keep me in the boat part. Mm. Like the side to side.
And you're not worried about falling out in Greenwall?
I mean, again, river level dependent. Like, I'm not going
Okay.
to say that Greenwell is not a big, scary rapid. Sure it is. But, especially if I'm in like, a raft, I feel like if I'm falling out of the raft, the pins and clips probably weren't going to help me. Like, whereas a
Yeah.
cat, I feel like it's easier to fall off of.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think that for a raft, it's the same with a cat. Because I'm gonna fall. You're probably a little bit more likely to fall out of a cat, I guess. But I've been saved in rafts many times because I have my pins and clips attached. So I'm an advocate of both. And it's actually usually going into a big hole, and then they're looking up really far, and you want to
Oh,
tumble out the back. And
yeah,
so
I can see that.
having the oars shipped, and you can just hold on to the oars, and go over that big drop, stay in the boat, and then just jump right back on the oars. Is big. And I guess it's me, like I don't let go of my oars. So I guess in that case, a lot of people would let go of their oars, grab the frame, get through that wave or hole or whatever, and then go find their oars.
But even on the Illinois, there's not that many spots where you're plugging into deep holes like that, right?
No.
Like
Well, if you're online, no.
flow dependent. So the next thing I was gonna ask you is,
Flow dependent.
yeah, so Eric, is there a flow on the Illinois where you're like, man, above 5,000, I'd want to have. Not that you're gonna do it at 5,000. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But is there a flow where you're like, I'm gonna take pins and clips above a certain level?
I don't think so. Like
Okay.
here's another reason I don't like pins and clips. So when you're pulling, so say you're doing a downstream ferry through waves, through holes, whatever you're having to pull, and the boat's getting jostled around, and some of this depends on how high you have your seat, but like when you're pulling, especially in waves, when you drop your hands down, pull your oars up, and you're going forward, your oar blade, depending again like on how low your knees are and some of that kind of stuff, how low you can actually get them, you can be still scraping holes and waves. As you're doing those maneuvers with your actual oar blades out. And if you can feather those in those situations, like that's super helpful. Like I'm trying to think of the rapids on the Illinois. There's numerous rapids where I feel like when I'm pulling like the upper part of Greenwall, if you're trying to catch those eddies, between kind of upper Greenwall and like main Greenwall, there's that big hole and I like to downstream ferry through there and then drop into that eddy. And when you're downstream ferrying, you're kind of downstream ferrying above that hole. And so you're having to move your oar blade, like you're trying to get it up and over that hole so it doesn't catch as you're coming by. And you can either ship it as you go by, which is one way to do it. But if you're actually having to try to make another pull, I find it's easier to get a couple more inches of clearance over waves if you can feather the oar in those pulls.
I've never had this problem you're talking about. I get it. I get what you're saying, but this has never been something I thought about.
I don't notice it as much. I will say that, like, I notice it much more in my dory than I do on rafts.
Okay. Is
But,
yours
like,
a.
I noticed it last time I was on the Illinois. I felt like I noticed it. Like,
Okay.
and maybe my seat was too high
So you're
compared to my
downstream
Orlocks.
ferrying and spinning your oars. What's that called again?
Oh, yeah.
Feathering. Your feather. Your shoe.
You
Your.
feather in your.
That's a lot to think about at once. Like you have to. Your brain is. Is downstream ferrying, trying to look behind you, keep an angle, and on top of that, you're having to feather the oar.
I suppose if you put it that way, it feels like that,
It
but
seems
like
crazy to me.
you do it long enough, you just kind of, I don't even really
Yeah.
think about it that
Okay.
much anymore.
Okay.
You notice it with really long oars too. So like longer oars are going to be more, you're going to notice it more like in an 18-foot boat. If you got 11-foot oars, it's a bigger issue than if you've got, 9-foot oars. Like big oars make a difference on that too.
Yeah.
Okay, let me try to summarize this again. I'm trying to get a handle on this, and I'm hopefully somebody can write me a nasty email about how I'm wrong. I'm really looking forward to that. So please bring it on. So let me go back to the generalization. You would not use pins and clips on a river with a lot of flat water. It would just be annoying. Or a river with
Definitely.
a lot of wind. It would be annoying. And some people would like pins and clips on harder rivers because you know exactly where your blade angle is. You can just yard on the oars. You don't have to think about feathering. But also they help you keep yourself in the boat if you're thrown laterally or back and forth. But
Sounds fair.
there's not many
There's a
people.
general.
Yeah. But as Eric, you can see that as the river gets harder than the Illinois, then you see the value of pins and clips. Like the Illinois is kind of
Yeah,
like on the fence. Like I could see using pins and clips. I'd rather use my oar locks. But as the river gets more difficult than the Illinois, I don't think the wind is definitely more difficult. It's just more compact. It's just back to back to back to back to back. There's no flat water
it's
to worry
more,
about.
Yeah, and that's, I think, that's the one for me. It's like, well, it's just more consistent. You know, like it's there's less the flat water issue. I will say I saw a couple people rowing pins and clips on the Grand, and I just remember thinking, like, that looks like it sucks.
But, I wouldn't mind it personally.
There
I
was,
would.
There was the one kicker that where I was like, that is rad. is they sat back and they rowed with their legs.
Yep.
I've they just put their feet up on the oar handles, and because the blades are consistent, and they just bicycled it.
Yep.
And I was like, That's awesome. All right, like.
I want to try that.
I'm not going to get him for that, but that is there's one win there. That's it.
You can do that with oarlocks too. It's just a bit harder. Or with
it's harder.
Or right, it's a bit harder.
Yeah. It's a lot harder. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that was the win that I did see there. I was like, that. All right, I get that. But I feel like we're especially seeing people with big boats with pins and clips. It just seems like they don't get where they need to go as often. Like, I feel like when you see people stock big boats in places, I feel like pins and clips are, you see them more than you don't. Does that make sense? Yeah. And that may be a total exaggeration.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I'm running the middle fork at 3 or 4 feet, I kind of see what you're saying. Maybe, probably not. But when I'm rowing the middle fork at 6 feet and above, I want pins and clips. And so I have a set of pins and clips in Idaho that I use. The rest of our guides don't. But I'm watching, when we're running these big continuous rapids and catching small eddies, I'm watching our guides like fluff strokes and like they're worried about it's spinning on top of just yarding the boat across the river. So, but when I'm running like velvet, having to make that pole, you know, it's six and a half feet, the pole to miss the big hole, I don't want to think at all about my oars fluffing or missing a stroke. I just want to yard on them as hard as I can to make that downstream ferry. So I've seen a lot of times where I'm watching people on open oar locks just missing a stroke here and there. That makes a difference.
You see people do it at Blossom. I've seen people do it there.
With or
miss strokes.
Yeah.
With, like open oar locks.
Because it's spun a little bit. It's just like,
well, just because they end up thinking about it. Like if you have to think about it, you maybe should think about that you're running water, white water that's harder than what you should be running. You know, like, I think there's that truth too of like, it takes more work. Like, this is another skill you have to learn. And so, you know, maybe you need to spend more time building into the places you are if you're going to be duffing strokes.
Yeah, this is a good segue maybe to oar rights. And maybe oar rights are a good solution for that for people that they don't, you know, that want to, it's an in-between. And I know people call oar rights training wheels a lot. What do you guys think about oar rights?
I think that's exactly what they are.
Yeah.
Training wheels. And I would say a couple of things. One, I think you're right. I think they can be really good for training people. We as a company, when we train people to row, don't use them. We're kind of I want you to start with what you're going to end up with and figure it out. And you'll get it as you do it. Rather than sort of giving you this thing and then you start to get the basics and then you have to learn to do another thing, you know, like on top of it. But I do see the benefit to it. I think there can be some real advantages. One of the things I struggle with again with that is for me, when I set up my oars, I'm putting the oar donuts like basically as far up the shaft as the ropes go.
You're one because of those guys. Actually, I
you
can't.
Don't row, well, you don't row off of them.
I do. Like, I cannot row without them.
I cannot row
without the donuts. When people move up the shaft, I move them back down when I have to get in that boat.
Oh, man.
That pins and clips background, man.
I'm telling you, it's hippies versus normal people here.
Oh, my gosh. No.
I think.
Maybe purists.
Purists.
I think you've got it backwards. I'm not really sure. And that's my one thing with those is that then you end up sitting with your hands more likely than not way too far out. So again, you're rowing super inefficiently using fewer muscles, versus if you have them in tighter, you get to use more of your core, you're using more of your abs, your lower back, your shoulders, like your triceps.
Yeah, but you can set them traps, there. You like, can set them so they're in tighter.
You can. But then, you know, like if you've got them in tight enough to push appropriately, then they're probably too tight to pull appropriately. That makes sense? Like, so you're either, there's like, your hands are different widths
So
depending on what you're
you
doing.
push and pull with different position of your oars. That is
Yeah,
you move them
if
in
I'm
and out
pulling,
based on pushing and
my hands are gonna be
pulling.
a little bit further out if I'm pulling more often than not. Like my hands are gonna be a little bit further out, not a lot. You're talking like inches, right? Like 4 or 5 inches. My hands are gonna be further out and wider when I'm pulling versus if I'm pushing, my hands are gonna be like, my hands are almost hitting each other. Like the oar handles are actually overlapping in my strokes when I'm pushing
Okay, let's go back to
more often than not.
Greenwald. Do you do this in Greenwald too? Have your donuts all the way at the end?
I mean, Greenwell's a lot of, if I'm pushing, then yeah, my hands are going to be in tight. And if I'm pulling, my hands are going to be wider.
So
Just depends on what I'm doing.
but your donuts will be at the very end, even on a rapid like Greenwald. You're allowing, you have all these degrees of freedom. You have like rowing, you have in and out, and you have spinny, your feathering. You have every one of those things
I want the most efficient ability for every stroke, you know? Like, for sure. So I'll add to this conversation. We should probably wind it down here pretty quick. One, so what about oar leashes?
You have to have them if you don't have pins and clips.
I used to be, I don't know, maybe it was because OTT never used them when I was there. I was pretty against them and I didn't know why. And then I did use them. I think I used them on Illinois because I was like, man, well, one, it was the first pair of oars, the only pair of oars I own. So it's like, I really don't want to lose these. And I also like don't want to have one oar way behind me in some long rapid and not be able to get it quickly. I think the length of the leash, I just used like cordelette to do it. So I determined that the length of the leash was a big thing to consider pretty quickly, because if it's too short, then it's really hard to get your oar back in if it falls out.
Wait, Eric, are you against oar leashes?
No, I mean, I think I used to be more so than I am now. Now I use them like on my dory, I use them. I use them on like if I'm running the Illinois, I'll have oar leashes just
What's the
because.
downside?
So there's a school of thought that you are better off having your oars positioned like your spare. So if you run two spare oars on a boat or even one. If you run them flat next to you where they're not strapped down, so you can just grab it and go. So, like you pop an oar, it is faster and more efficient to pick up your spare oar from right next to you, slide it into the oar locks and go, than it is to jump over the side, try and fish the oar back, pull it up, get the oar leash out of the way, and try and slide it in. And if you're not going to grab that oar that just popped and went, you don't want it attached to you because it's more drag.
You still have to go
So,
chase the, this is less efficient because you still have to go chase the oar though that you that fell
yeah,
off your boat.
but it's not in your way if you're trying to pull it off of a rock or something like that. Like if you're trying to avoid some hazard, now you've got a giant sea anchor strapped to the side of your boat. So it's better, you're better off to just let it go and pick it up down in the pool at the bottom. You know, again, I think that's more applicable, say like on the Maine salmon or, you know, somewhere that's real pool droppy, like the Rogue even, than it is,
Wait, so the
even on the middle
spare oar is
fork.
just sitting next to you,
Yeah,
just
I don't
unattached.
strap. Like one of my biggest pet peeves is strapping the spare oars to the side, like to the frame on the side of the boat.
What?
Like that drives me insane.
What? That's what everybody does.
Everybody that, you know, doesn't know what they're doing. I don't know.
Oh
Like I don't.
my God. This is like
I have seen numerous people break oars that way. When they slam into a wall, they end up breaking their spare oar. Like I've watched that
not
happen.
occasionally. I don't, man.
But if it was in
Wait,
your boat somewhere, that
it's
wouldn't have happened.
in your
But
boat
then.
just sitting there chilling out, just not even
Well,
tied
no,
down.
no,
Yeah, or like, you know,
no. On a raft, like on a big boat, I'll have, you know, something strapped down in the front, probably like a stack in the front. And I would, or if I didn't, I would have a loose strap somewhere up by where like the front of the oar is, so that it's not just gonna like fall off the side, but it's loose enough that if I grab the oar, I can just grab it, pull it out, slide it in the oar lock and go. Like I don't want to miss. If I'm grabbing my spare oar, I shouldn't be missing more than two oar strokes. Is the way I look at it, at most. I should be able, by the time I do my second oar stroke, I should have the oar in and go. Because if I'm in the middle of like going in to make the pull at Blossom and I crab the downstream oar and it pops out, if I can't get to my spare oar quick, I'm screwed. And if I can get to it, I
Yeah,
still have a
you
chance.
are. That's why you run pins and clips, so you don't pop it to begin with.
Well, if you crab it, you're still gonna break it. Like it's not gonna, you know, you're not gonna pop it, but you're gonna break it in half.
I've done this. I've done this before. We were talking about capoding. Put the ore on the inside. If I think I'm gonna hit a lot of walls, protect it, or if I need it, get it really quickly. But I can't imagine running a gearboat where that ore would even go.
Oh, gearboats are the easiest ones. They're like
You just put it on the metal.
It's a small, like, personal 14-foot boat. Like that's where it's the hardest to find somewhere. Gearboats are easy.
I agree.
This is them right in there. I love it.
On the 14-foot boats, if I'm not running like a bunch of people that are sitting on the side tubes, I've figured out a way to strap the spare oar that's more on the top side of the tube, like even kind of towards the inside of the boat, and have kind of the like one or two loose straps type of deal. And I do like that, but you run into issues with that setup if you have a lot of people in your boat.
I run it like on the flat deck, like on the inside of the oar locks.
All right, we need to have a whole show about this. I think that I'm a normal, reasonable person, and you guys are purists, and we need to get more people. This is insane to me. This is all news. I didn't know this is a thing.
Will. We should get Will Volpert on this to talk about it, because he's a phenomenal oarsman.
Wait, is he
Will's
on?
Great.
Is
Will's
he on your side on this one? Do you already know?
I guarantee you he's on my side. No, I have no idea, but I can guess because he's a good oarsman. He is.
Oh, man. Okay. I think we should we've covered this one enough, but
I
want to try to wrap it up. A couple of things. Well, I want to go back to one thing first. I don't think oar rights are training wheels. I personally think more people should use them. Going back to what we were talking about, where we were going with people fluffing strokes at Blossom Bar. I think that if you row a lot and are very, very experienced, having spinnies is fine. But I think there's a lot of people out there, especially private boaters, who don't row all the time. And they should have oar rights, and calling them training wheels is like makes them not take them. They think that they're cooler or better if they don't use them. And I prefer to. I wish there was a different name
Maybe
for them.
Maybe they are.
But I think more people should. Yeah, I think more people should be using oar rights, because when we teach a lot, we see people fluffing strokes all the time, and it would just go away. And there's not a huge advantage for people if you know how to feather and do all those things, and you don't need them, cool. But I think they're useful. And I know that the people I know that are some of the best cat boaters in the world, they run – what they run is oar rights with these little bungee straps to hold the oars in, to hold them in the boat. I don't know if that makes sense. So there's a bungee –
At that point, it seems like
– You should just have pins and clips.
Yeah, that makes the least sense to me, to be honest. But I will say, if you're like, – I don't wholly disagree with what you're saying on the oar rights. I think that makes – They can be a very useful tool. And if you are going to set them up so that they're at the width of your pulling strokes, because that's where most people duff their strokes.
Yeah.
And your hands, when you're doing pulling strokes, should be further out anyway.
Yeah.
And then you still have the freedom with it. So one thing I like about those, when you still have the freedom to then slide them in for, you know, pushing strokes and feathering for your pushing and stuff. So.
Yeah, I like that. I haven't thought that much about, I've never thought before about having different oar lengths for pushing and pulling, but that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so I'm good. That was the one thing I wanted to mention. I just hope like that we can somewhat agree on for easier rivers, oar rights, or not oar rights, spinnies, or what are they called again? Open oar, for easier rivers, open oar locks, and then some people for harder rivers prefer pins and clips. Does that seem like a generalization?
It's a reasonably fair generalization.
Okay. I think what we need to get into is like another talk.
But I don't.
You don't like the generalization?
I mean, it's an for a very broad generalization that I don't wholly agree with, it is appropriate.
Okay. Maybe we should
we can go forward with it.
We should have a talk in the future about, I think there's some definite like styles of boating, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's like, I'm going to call your styles purist. Is that correct?
I'm not going to stop you.
I think we should, I'm trying to think about this. Like maybe there's like, and there's different like geographical, like some places they only do this, some places they only do that. And maybe try to maybe have a talk and pin down like different style, like kind of like Priscilla stereotyped boaters. We could stereotype types of rowers at some point.
Oh, I think there's a huge
awesome.
who was it? Emerald from Red Side Foundation. I
Yeah.
follow her on Instagram, and like literally yesterday, she put some like, you know, section of videos up. They were on some like, I think, a lower salmon trip, and they were rowing out the snake and got really bored. And so they did like this video segment of different types of rowers.
Nice.
And it's her boyfriend or whatever is like acting out the different styles of rowing. And she puts the commentary next to it. It's not only like it's hilarious, but it's also she was super accurate. It was like the
That's
Middle
awesome.
Fork drift boat guide versus the Grand Canyon baggage boatman versus the, you know, whatever. And it was like, you really kind of nailed it here. This is awesome.
Awesome. Maybe we should just post that on an on the
That might be
site.
enough.
Yeah.
So,
Cool.
yeah, there's some real truth to it anyway. The different styles of boatmen for different areas.
Nice.
This is a hot topic. This is almost as hot as whether or not to drain the water out of your coolers. It's like one of those things that
Or use
man.
umbrellas.
or using
Oh
umbrellas.
yeah, that'll be a future talk.
Okay, I'm ready to move on.
Sweet.
All
All right,
right.
gear of the
Gear
week. Let's
of the
finish it
week.
out.
All right. Zach, you seem pretty excited about your gear of the week.
Yeah, well, first of all, while we were on this, I got a text from Corey, who works for you guys at Orange Torpedo, and he texted me a photo of his Paddling America book, the one that Susan and Adam Elliott wrote. And he texted me River Talk podcast pre-order suggestion. And so thank you,
Wow.
Corey, for ordering the book. And I think I just got mine too. It's a great book, and I highly recommend that as a book to grab for anybody. But my gear of the week are Super Guide throw bags. Have you guys heard of these?
No.
No.
Okay, I found this on Instagram somehow, and it's this guy. I think he works for Kern River Tours. I'm not sure completely. He somehow knows the Volperts, and I think he works for them. And he makes these beautifully made, hand custom, handmade throw bags that are what I like in a throw bag. I don't like big loops over the top that are like danger loops for your hand. And it has a little pocket for a carabiner, and it's just like they're very well thought out, and they're handmade, sort of artisanal throw bags. And even if you don't buy one, they're like $110 though. Even if you don't buy one, just following them on Instagram is worth it because it's just they're beautiful bags, and he'll custom make them. They're very, I dare say, hipster. I mean, it's
What are
like
they called?
Super Guide throw bags.
Okay.
And I don't know, I
So
just.
I'm Googling that right now and I do not see.
Well, he's new to the internet, I think. The guy's doing it. I don't know for sure. He's on Instagram for
So
sure.
where.
Just go to Super Guide Throw Bags on Instagram, and he has a website for sure. But I'm
I
a
can't
fan.
find it.
I found his Facebook
You
page.
guys,
That's what pops up.
there you go. You guys gotta be better at
Okay.
the internet.
All right.
Superguidegear.com.
Oh,
Yeah,
Super
yeah.
Guide Gear.
Super
There we
Guide
go.
Gear.
Okay.
And I don't know, I just really enjoy well thought out, handmade things by small businesses. I
Yeah.
haven't thrown this throw bag yet, but I'm pretty sure I'm gonna like it. And it has a big wide opening to stuff
Oh,
the rope in
these
and
look
stuff
like
with.
the Prion throw bags, but they have a belt.
They have a belt. I took my belt off. I'm not a belt throw bag person. But
That was another topic I wanted to do here at some point.
oh great.
We'll do it at some point.
Wait, is
I'm really
wait.
curious about this.
Wait, I
These do look
really
cool.
like calling you guys purists, and it's just me being the jerk that I can be sometimes. But as a purist, I'm guessing you wouldn't like the waist belt. Am I right or am I wrong?
Another conversation for another time. Yeah, we'll
Oh,
get
the
into it.
suspense.
I
The
will say
suspense.
I appreciate I like this guy's website. The first thing that pops up, like their header, is "Don't do stupid things." But
Yeah.
when you do, bring protection.
Nice.
Yeah,
It's
I'm into
like
this.
great
And these throw bags look
enthusiasm.
rad.
He was when he made mine, he was making one for Skip Volpert. And those of you who don't know, Skip Volpert and his brother Matt own Idaho River Journeys and Kern River Tours. And I will send you a patch, a Northwest Rafting Company patch to put on Skip's throw bag. And I tried to overnight it to him in time, and I didn't get it to him in time. But he was willing to put
Oh,
my patch on Skip's throw bag.
that would have been awesome.
I like this guy's. I don't even know him. I just like his whole vibe. I like what he's doing. Like, keep it up.
Yeah, it's
And
awesome.
he sent me a hat, and I'm repping the hat. I'm gonna be wearing the hat for the next 6 months, probably. It's comfortable.
But that had no influences to you bringing it up here as your gear of the week,
The
correct?
free hat.
Yeah. You were not influenced by the swag.
I was not influenced, but I could be influenced by future swag.
Yeah,
There you
exactly.
go. There you go.
No, these look awesome.
They
I'm
do look
into it.
awesome. Yeah.
All right,
Nice.
Priscilla, do you have gear of
Yeah.
the week?
Yeah, so mine's nothing new, but this morning Jacob and I were talking about something to bring on river trips when it gets cold, like instead of like beer or whatever after. And I was like, well, why don't we start having hot cocoa like on the river? And we had this talk about it'd be awesome just to bring our jet boil on all of our trips and have like a hot cocoa break. Or like after we're done kayaking, have like actual hot cocoa. And I really like that idea. So I think my excitement for that idea will turn my gear of the week into like powdered hot cocoa and a jet boil, just something to throw in, like, your Ekowe bag or dry bag or whatever little dry setup you have on your kayak or raft. As a like little reward for boating and keep you warm. So I'm pretty stoked to try
You know what's easier than taking a jet boil and packets and making it? Taking a
Yeah.
thermos with it already
I
in there.
know. I know. But
And it
then you're
is, it's like the
limited on
best on
how
a cold
much.
day. So rad. It's like the best on a cold day.
Yeah.
Single day trip, you're good. It's
Yeah.
the best.
Yeah.
I had something, there was something in the last day where I was like, this is a gear of the week item. And I totally forgot what it
I have
was.
another one.
So,
I'll do two if you want for you.
all right, Zach, take mine.
Okay, I have this, it's on my desk. That's why I'm noticing it. I have this IR thermometer. It costs like $50. It's like a Fluke 62 Max IR thermometer. It's a laser. You can point at a river and it will tell you the temperature.
Those are fun. Those are fun.
And so you
That
can.
is the
People always
dumbest.
ask me like, how cold is the river? I'm like, I don't know. It's like 50 degrees.
So
Like,
you got
no,
a
that's not
laser.
possible. I don't have any understanding of how I can't relate temperature of a water to a number. I don't have that ability. So I've been carrying this around with me, learning what the temperature of rivers are. And not only can you tell the temperature of the river, you can tell the temperature of your friends, your car. You can point a laser at things and know what the temperature is. It's really interesting.
It's like a superpower, a really weird,
It
obscure
is. And
superpower.
so, and I think it's like $50. I can tell you right now, my computer screen is 79.6 degrees. Fascinating.
I'm fascinated.
So, I mean, it's a good thing too. I think there's some rules we maybe we'll talk about someday where, like, if the combined air temperature and water temperature is less than 100, you should be smart on the river.
Yeah,
This
the
is a good,
hypothermia rules.
yeah. So this would be a way to know. Sometimes you just go out and you're like, oh, we're fine. But maybe you might want to check the water temperature and go, that's just a little added danger today because the river's 40.
There you go.
And so I've been carrying my truck and using it as much as I can. I like data.
Nice. We'll wait the
Yeah.
spreadsheet. Sweet.
Right on. Well, I think that winds us down for the day. So thanks for coming and listening, hanging out with us while we talked about fins and clips and rowing and all that kind of fun stuff. Hopefully you have found some water somewhere. There's not a whole lot to be found this time of year, but it's coming. So get out, go boat, and start planning those big winter trips. And yeah, we'll see you next time.